Hello and welcome back to Journey of the Monkey King. Myself and MJ took a much needed break, but we have returned.
We have. We were so tired.
Yeah, that was pretty much it.
Very tired. Just very, very, very tired.
While we were gone, I got my first email from someone asking to join a podcast network.
Ooh, okay. That's amazing. Who was it? What's the network? Are we doing it?
Oh god, no. It was like clearly a form letter. I've already forgotten the name.
Okay. That's fair. Oh, is it a PodSpring thing? Because I think I got one of those.
No, I don't think so. Unless it was like someone actually wrote a really heartfelt thing after listening to us and now they're hearing us say this and now they're really heartbroken, but...
We're sorry. You just can't trust anyone.
No, I'm not really.
You're not?
No.
You're just going to break this poor person's heart?
Yeah, I don't care. Anyway.
Okay, so welcome to a Journey of the Monkey King with the Ice Queen and MJ.
So do you remember where we left off?
Let's say, for the purposes of giving good exposition, that I don't. He's stuck in a mountain at this point. He's been broken out of the mountain, and we had a really very troubling, because I remember we recorded that episode around the time that the protests were really starting to kick off in the States. So we had a very troubling journey.
Yeah, I actually put a message at the start of the episode about that kind of when I went back to edit it. But actually, we are going to leave the Monkey King rotting in jail for a while.
Oh God, really? Still?
Yeah. Yeah, so the we're kind of going into the second part of the story now, and we're going to kind of leave gods and monsters behind for a little bit.
Okay. So I guess they're still going to be there when we get back. They're quite famously okay without human intervention.
Yeah, and this chapter is quite violent, actually. It's going to involve murder, suicide, attempted infanticide, capital punishment, dismemberment, and disembowelment. And like I said, unusually for the book, it's a chapter that mostly focuses on ordinary humans and not godly beings, which I feel makes the violence a little less detached, maybe?
Yeah, humans are the real monsters. Yeah.
There's also a forced marriage that happens, and that obviously implies certain things, though there's nothing in the text directly stating that those things happen.
Great.
And so I guess let's leave it at that. This chapter starts off in Chang'an, capital of the Tang Dynasty, on the 13th year of the Emperor Taizong's reign, and that would put us in about the mid-7th century.
Okay,
so we actually kind of have a firm time frame now.
I don't want to interject too much on this one, but how old is Monkey at the moment? How old is Sun Wukong?
So,
is he like 7 centuries?
He's been trapped under the mountain for 500 years.
Oh, okay, so he's quite a bit older now.
So he was trapped under the mountain, so he's been trapped under the mountain since about, like, the mid-200s.
Okay.
And I kind of forget how old he was before that. I think he was... Was it he was 100 and something when he died? Oh no, sorry. He was 342 years when he died.
Okay, so he's a bit older than Jesus, because that's where my Western Judeo-Christian mind, Judeo-Christian trained mind went. It was a monkey Jesus, because I thought he was 700 at this point. But he is not. He is not Jesus. Continue.
No, he's older than Jesus. Very importantly. Okay.
Jesus is, yeah, I'm not even gonna,
yeah, let's no, move on. Strangely, despite Buddha calling the land of the east last chapter an ignorant and violent place, we're now given a description of a peaceful and prosperous land, and the emperor is looking to re-establish state examinations to fill up empty administrative posts. That's his most pressing concern.
We're back to the civil service.
Yeah, and he issues a decree to hold a 3-stage examination in every town in the country, and those who pass will be invited to Chang'an to take imperial examinations. And even peasants are allowed to take part in the examinations. Anyone can be raised up. There's a, made a point of saying that, despite the fact that the person we're about to move on to is not a peasant.
Okay, but just so you know, I'm cool with peasants, okay? Some of my best friends are peasants. It's fine. I don't have anything against the peasants. So don't even start. I don't know why you would even say that. Just stop.
Just so you know, it's supposedly a meritocracy.
Okay.
So in the Haizhou district, a man named Chen Yi or Chen Guangri. I'm really not sure of the phonetics here. Sorry. G-U-A-N-G or U-I.
Well, I can't help you there.
Yeah, so he decides to take state examinations and make his family proud. He's definitely not a peasant. There's not really any much detail on his family's wealth, but they have a page serving them, at least, so...
Right.
They have at least one servant.
Cool.
Chen aces the preliminary tests and he gets the highest marks in the imperial examinations. And that gets him the title of Zhang Wan. And as custom, he's paraded through the streets of Chang'an for 3 days.
That seems like a lot of walking.
He has a horse.
That seems like a lot of walking for the horse.
Fair. This parade at one point passes the house of the chief minister, Ying Kaishan. Do you remember when we were talking about embroidered balls in chapter 4?
Vividly.
So I had forgotten about that part when we were saying that.
How could you forget? It was such a moment.
No, I when we were in that chapter, I had forgotten about this part that was coming up.
Okay.
Yin's daughter Wen Zhao is unmarried, and she was in the process of selecting a husband by a tradition of throwing an embroidered ball down from a tower of their house.
And just whoever she hits on the head is just
destined to be her husband.
Congratulations, you have a concussion and an upcoming wedding. Don't think too hard about it.
Though in this case, Wen Zhao sees Chen passing in front of the house, and she sees him and thinks, you know, I want some of that. And throws the ball directly at his head.
She knows what she wants.
Yeah. She also...
What can we say?
He's handsome, and she recognizes the procession means he aced the exams. And that's nice. Hot, apparently.
So, yeah, well, I mean, he's on the up and up. He's
true.
Getting a good station in life.
He's going to get
pretty.
A good job.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you gotta be thinking ahead.
And so when the ball hits him, suddenly a bunch of maids rush out from the house, just grab the bridle of his horse and drag him inside, and a wedding is just sort of immediately assembled around him.
Oh God. So he's literally, but possibly concussed, and just like, and now suddenly married.
I mean, I think it was a fabric ball.
Okay, yeah, I don't know why I like to imagine it the other way. It is far more horrifying.
This is not the forced marriage I mentioned before.
Okay, it kind of feels like it's a bit of a forced marriage.
Yeah, like in fairness, but Cheng is quite happy with this arrangement, and they get married, and it's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not saying that seems like a great idea either, but it's not what I was referring to in the warning.
Just in case
you like thought you could, you know, relax now.
Okay, it's good to know that I should be prepared for something worse.
Yeah.
Yay.
So having first place in the state exams, and now being married into the family of the chief minister. Chen is just given a job as governor of Jiangzhou.
Okay, so he's landed on his feet there, pretty much. Did he like immediately recognize that this is the daughter of someone important and kind of go, okay, cool?
I mean, when you get dragged into a palace and a massive wedding gets assembled around you, they clearly have money.
Yeah, so it's just kind of like this saves some time for him.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So him and his wife head out to take his new post, and they pick up Chen's mother on the way and bring her with them. And after a few days on the road, they come to the Inn of 10,000 Flowers, and Chen's mother is not feeling great, and she asks to stay at the inn for a couple of days to rest.
And they were like, oh, thank God. Sorry. There's probably... I don't want to make a mother-in-law joke, really.
No, they stay with her. Like, they're not... They don't just immediately abandon her there.
Okay. Well, my relationship with my mother is great. But... I think 2 days on the road with her, I love her. I love her very, very much. But 2 days on the road with her without anything else to do but talk, I think there would be a body. I can't tell you whose it would be. add in my new, you know, possibly brain damaged husband. I know it's a fabric ball. I don't know why that's the hill I chose to die on. Yeah, add in that, I would just kind of be happy to, like, okay, cool, we'll see you when we get back. Never.
while they're staying at the inn, Chen buys a golden carp off a fisherman outside the inn, but after he takes it, he realizes it's still blinking.
Oh dear.
So he reckons this is no ordinary fish, and he asks the man where he caught it. And the fisherman tells him he got it from the River Han, which is about 15 miles away. And Chen goes there and releases the fish back into the water as his good deed for the day.
How far did he go to release this fish?
15 miles. Or, well, so like we said before, that's like each of these miles is only like half a kilometer. So like 7.5 kilometers.
Oof. Okay.
I mean, again, I'm pretty sure he has like a horse and servants, and actually probably more than a horse, he probably has his own carriage for traveling and everything. But in any case, later that day he talks with his mother about the journey, and he is a bit worried about delaying things for too long, but she isn't feeling any better and she doesn't think she can travel in the heat of the summer, so she asks for him to leave her some money to rent a room until autumn and then come back for her.
Okay, cool. Bye.
So you weren't far off, in fairness, I guess, but...
That's fair. I'm not advocating leaving your mother in strange places and just many, many days travel from where you're going. I'm not saying that that's always the best course of action. I'm just saying sometimes it's better for everyone.
So after leaving the inn, Chen and Wen Zhao come to the crossing for the River Hong, and they hire two boatmen, Lui Hong and Li Biao, to ferry them across. And so Lui and Li bring the boat to an isolated area on the river and wait until the middle of the night before murdering Chen and his houseboy in their sleep and throwing the bodies into the river.
Well, that took a turn.
Yeah, it's quite sudden. Like, even in the story itself, it's quite sudden.
I mean, you know, I just gotten invested in this guy, and immediately he's just been murdered now.
So when Zhao sees what's happening, she tries to dive into the water, but Lui Hong grabs her and tells her that if she does as he says, she won't be harmed. And when they're on the other side of the river, Hong takes Chen's belongings, puts on his clothes, and takes Wei Zhao to Jianzhou to impersonate Chen and take up his job as governor.
Oh no, okay. Okay.
So, meanwhile, Chen's body sinks to the bottom of the river. They actually explicitly state that his servant's body just kind of floats away, but his one sinks.
Right.
Because magic destiny, because there is a yaksha patrolling.
Is the fish going to do him a solid?
Yes.
The fish is doing him a solid. Yep. Okay.
So a yaksha patrolling the bottom of the river finds the body and reports it back to his local dragon king, who was in fact the golden carp that Chen released back into the river.
Okay.
And so when he sees the body, he's shocked that the man who saved his life has just drowned or just died and been thrown into his river. So he sends off a yaksha with an official dispatch to the municipal deity and local spirit of Hangzhou, asking for Chen's soul.
I love how there's a municipal deity.
Yeah.
I love how this is, I guess, you know, like folklore wise, you know, there's like, what are they called? Like genii locorum, or like spirits that just belong to a place and are just kind of intrinsically linked to them. But I don't know if it's the translation or just the mythos itself. But I love that the fact that it's just like, okay, so this is clearly a local authority problem, so we're going to bring it there first. And
I mean, like, you know, he's literally filing official paperwork for the request of this guy's soul.
I like that. I like that a lot.
Like, regardless of how the word municipal is being translated there, that is what is happening.
I really like that.
So, the soul is handed over, and the Dragon King gives his spirit a temporary job in his water bureau as an officer, as a measure to, like, keep his soul from passing on.
So being dead did not save him from the civil service.
No, but
yeah, you will never escape.
he's been given a cushy job as an excuse to keep his soul around for the moment.
Which... Yeah, this is also very. Yeah. Okay.
And he takes the body and he puts a magic pearl in his mouth to stop the body from rotting in the meantime as well.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So they're keeping his body and soul in the palace, but separate for the moment.
Yeah. Repair work to be completed, presumably once the correct paperwork is filed.
So meanwhile, Hong takes up Chen's position as governor of Jiangzhou, and he manages to pass himself off without incident, which is impressive, to be honest. Waijiao fantasizes about killing and eating him, but she's pregnant and she's too worried about her future child to try anything.
Oh, of course.
Eventually...
And eating him?
Yeah, yes, that's part of it.
Yeah, I just caught up to that. Okay. Okay. I won't spoil it.
I can quote it directly. We tell you now that Lady Yin hated the bandit Liu so much that she wished she could devour his flesh and sleep in his skin.
Sleep in his... Oh, wow, that is metal as fuck. I don't know. That's a bit... I don't... I would have thought kind of, I never want to see this person again. I don't think I would want to sleep in my captor's skin. I mean, maybe as a once-off, as a kind of a fuck you, but certainly not as a sustained. there's a level of intimacy there that I don't think I'd be... Okay, let's just move quickly on, shall we?
And the plot does move quickly on. The next thing is she eventually gives birth alone in the garden of the governor's mansion and passes out.
Oh dear.
When she's asleep, the star spirit of the South Pole comes to her in her sleep and whispers in your ear. He tells her that he was sent by Guanyin and that Waiju must protect her son, but Hong will try and kill him when he returns. And that's basically it. When Waijiao, I'm pretty sure I'm not being consistent in how I'm pronouncing these names, but I'm, you know, not exactly certain on Ming Chinese phonetics.
We'll let the internet call you out on it. They're going to be pretty civil about it, I think. They usually are.
When she wakes up, she holds her newborn son tightly to her chest, but she can't think of any plan to actually protect him.
Yeah. I mean, they did just say that and just fuck off.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just kind of like you've just literally pushed a human out of you, which I have not done myself, but I've heard it is not the easiest thing to do. And that there is often, like, blood and, you know, you'd probably be pretty just tired.
Well, she literally passed out.
Straight off. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. And, I mean, and it's just kind of like, hey, person who's just shoved something the size of a melon at something the size of an orange, you're going to be in mortal danger. The thing that you've just created that you've now have a bond with is going to be in mortal danger. So, I also kind of feel like she probably would have got that anyway.
When Hong returns and sees that his wife, his fake wife, his prisoner.
I'm going to go with prisoner.
Yeah, sees his prisoner has given birth. He demands to have the baby drowned. And all Wai Zhao can manage is to tell him it's already late and let's just wait until morning. Which he does, but
okay.
He's called away on urgent business in the morning, so she gets a little bit more time to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
So she bites her own finger and writes a letter in her blood, explaining who the baby is.
She is just, yeah, metal as fuck, this lady.
And then she bites off the little toe of the left foot of the baby to leave as an identifying mark. As, like, future proof of the baby's identity.
Like, isn't the toe gonna, like, rot? I mean, and perhaps the baby will be bigger? At some point, they do grow, I hear. Again, not knowing much personally, but I've been told they grow.
This is what she does. I don't have any better explanation other than yep.
She bit off her own son's toe.
Yep.
Okay. I mean, she's possibly the most interesting character we've come across so far.
So, she sneaks out of the mansion to the bank of the river, and she grabs a plank that's floating by and ties the baby to it along with the letter, and Moseses him down the river.
To Moses as a verb is quite cool.
So she's hoping that whoever finds the baby will save him and take care of him.
Aww.
So the plank washes up in front of the Temple of Gold Monastery, and the abbot, whose name is Monk Fa Ming, hears the baby crying and runs over to rescue it, and he takes it in and names him River Float. Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a poor River Float would not have had a good time in school.
Well, he's raised in the monastery and becomes a monk.
Probably for the best.
And he is eventually ordained as a monk and is given the religious name of Xuanzang, which I believe means something like powerful mystery.
Ooh. Powerful mystery.
So, 18 years later, Xuanzang is having a spirited argument outside with some of the other monks, and one monk is losing the debate quite badly and loses his temper at Xuanzang and shouts, "What do you know? You don't even know your own name. You don't even know who your parents are."
Oh, so you just called him a bastard, basically.
Yeah, he's a dickhead.
And this is special orphan boy. Yeah. So some shit's about to go down.
River Float is, like, understandably really upset by this, and he goes to Fa Ming crying and begs to learn who his parents were. So the abbot brings him into his own cell and shows him the letter from his mother, which he still has.
Oh.
So Xuanzang asks for permission to go find his mother, and Faming tells him to go, but to pretend to be a medicat monk and to go to the governor's mansion to beg for alms.
Okay.
So when he goes, Hong isn't there, and Wai Zhao invites him inside. And she notices that his speech and his mannerisms are really similar to her husband's because, you know, that's heritable. That's how genetics works.
Yeah.
And she starts to ask him about his family. He tells her who he is, but she demands proof. So he hands over her letter written in blood. And at this, they both break down and hold each other while crying.
Aww.
Which, you know, also, he had the letter. The toe thing was really unnecessary.
Yeah, actually, yeah. Well, I suppose she wanted to make sure, like, someone else could have gotten a hold of that letter. And does she check the toe?
Not right now.
Okay. But she's gonna, because I'll be really disappointed, to be honest, if she doesn't.
She does in a minute. They don't do it right now.
Okay.
So she tells him he needs to leave at once in case Hong comes back and gets suspicious or whatever. But she promises to visit his temple.
Okay.
So in the morning after, she pretends to be sick and tells her captor, I guess we're going with.
Captor. I'm going to go with captor. Anything else?
I had supposed husband written in my script, but I think that's a bit too nice.
Yeah, no.
She makes up a story to tell Hong. She tells him that she once made an unfulfilled vow to donate 100 pairs of shoes to monks.
What?
Yeah. And she had a dream of a monk threatening her with a knife and demanding the vow be fulfilled.
For shoes.
For demanding the shoes. and she's been feeling sick.
For your shoelaces.
And she's been feeling sick ever since.
Oh, Christ. Okay. I mean, this woman is just...
Her mind is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, just like, what is it like to live in your brain?
She's been through a lot.
She has. Jesus Christ, she has. But she went straight to the toe-biting. And she kind of knew what she wanted straight away. She kind of like... You know, oh, I'm going to leave this up to fate. Oh, no, actually, that one. I want that one. Yeah. I want that one now. And then, like, pretty much immediately, not that, you know, wishing violence towards your captor in possibly some really graphic and imagined ways is that all sorts of valid, but went immediately to eat them and sleep in their skin. Which, you know, it gives me two options. Either this is a very interesting person, or think about what... Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, okay, the shoe thing, we're just... And the guy just buys into the shoe thing?
Oh yeah, Hong is fine with that. He figures 100 pairs of shoes is a pretty trivial matter for a governor, so... He just sends out some stewards to order 100 families to bring a pair of shoes to Governor's Mansion within 5 days. I feel like he's probably not a very good governor.
I imagine not.
This is kind of the only detail we get of his entire administration. But he's been running this place for 18 years and that's just, oh, you want 100 shoes? We'll just take them off people.
Okay.
But yeah, she takes the 100 shoes and... brings them to the temple and they're like, okay, and they have a big banquet and ceremonies to celebrate the donation. After all the other monks have kind of petered out, Xuanzang, Wai Zhao and Faming are left alone, and this time Wai Zhao does demand to see her son's left foot to double check that, and okay. When she sees the missing toe, they kind of embrace and hug and cry a bit again.
Aww.
And I imagine there was a bit of, wait, that's why I don't have a fucking toe?
Yeah, yeah. Did she just say, oh, like, he's just meeting his mother for the first time, and it's just like, yeah, bit off your toe when you were a baby.
When you were like...
By the way.
When you were like 12 hours old.
Yeah, yeah. Like you were literally, you just popped out of me. I bit your toe off. I don't know. I was thinking in the moment. that's where like if you could just like yes and my decision here, this is that'd be cool.
But she has a plan now, and she gives her son a letter to take to her father in Chang'an,
Okay.
and tells him on the way to stop by the 10,000 Flowers Inn and, you know, check if his grandmother's still fucking alive.
Oh shit.
She's been there for 18 years.
Feel like Nana should have blown the whistle, to be honest. Or, just at least asked some
She
questions.
probably could have sent a messenger in the last 18
Yeah.
years.
You know, it's just kind of like, hey, it's kind of edging into winter now. You
Oh.
about? You free to pick me up, maybe? Take your time.
Yeah, so River Float, our boy Xuanzang travels to the inn, which is 1500 miles to the northwest apparently. But he gets there without issue, and he asks about his grandmother, and she stayed there for 3 or 4 years before being kicked out for not being able to pay any rent.
Oh no.
And since then, she's been living in a dilapidated potter's kilned near the southern gate of town, and she's gone blind from crying constantly and begs in the street every
Oh.
day.
Oh no. Oh dear.
Apparently, crying can make you go blind.
Well, that's now. That's now. I'm worried about that.
So, Xuanzang meets his grandmother and explains to her why no one ever came back from her. And he prays to heaven to restore his grandmother's eyesight and then licks her eyes, which heals them. I don't know, like if someone's like, we'll cure your blindness, but I have to lick your eyes, I'd almost be like, is there a different treatment?
I like music more now.
Braille is fine, actually.
I'm listening to loads of really good podcasts.
And when she sees her grandson for the first time, she remarks that he looks just like her son.
Aw, poor lady.
So he brings her back to the inn and leaves her with money to rent a room again and promises he'll be back in a month. I would be terribly worried if I was that woman.
I don't think I would. I'd go for that. I'm just like, bitch, I'm coming with.
Yeah, no, she
I'm
stays in
old,
the
but
inn.
you can slow down.
At least a different inn.
Oh, was it the same inn? Oh no. Oh. Although I gotta say, if she didn't send any sort of messenger, that's kind of on her.
So Zhajiang proceeds to the capital and delivers his mother's letter and meets his grandfather, Yin Kaishan, for the first time. So Yin, being the chief minister, is able to go straight to the emperor, and he asks for permission to go to Jiangzhou himself and deal with Louis Hong personally. The emperor is pretty pissed that someone has been impersonating a governor of his for 18 years, and gives
Yeah.
Yin 60,000 soldiers to take Zhangzhou. And when they arrive there, they meet with the local sub-prefect and county judge, and explain their mission, and they join their own forces with the army, and they completely surround the governor's mansion in the middle of the night. They don't even wait till dawn before blowing the gates down with a cannon, storming in and capturing Hong. They're
Shit.
really pissed. So it says they take the rest of the prisoners to the field of execution without saying who the other prisoners are, which makes it seem like they're just executing the entire mansion staff.
Yeah, man, I mean...
Which is a bit concerning.
Like, what, you're just, I don't know, you're dusting tables for your boss who's a cunt, but, you know, as far as you know, he's the cunt that's going to be paying you forever, and then suddenly someone takes you outside and shoots you?
There's only two people in that entire building who knew who he was.
Yeah. Kind of feels like, yeah. Oof.
In any case, with the mansion taken, Kaishan sends an invitation to his daughter to come out to meet him, but she's overcome by shame at the prospect of facing her father, and she tries to hang herself.
Oh, God.
Xuan Zhang and Kai Shen hear what she's doing and they rush in to stop her. She blames herself for...
So she's just hanging herself really loudly?
I don't know exactly how they knew what she was doing. Maybe like a servant saw her tying up a noose. It's not really said.
Fair.
But she blames herself for giving in to Hong, and that her only reason for living was her son, and now he's fully grown. And her father has... you know, avenged her husband, so there's nothing left for her now. Her father tells her...
take up gardening!
Her father tells her she shouldn't be ashamed for doing what she had to survive, and they manage to talk her down.
Aww.
Yin Kaishan goes to the execution site to see Hong killed. And in the meantime, the sub-prefect manages to apprehend Li Biao, the other guy who murdered the dad. They just get him somewhere, I don't know, it's fine. They're both flogged 100 times with canes and made to sign a confession, which is not a terribly good method of conviction, I must say.
No.
And then they are executed quite awfully. Li is nailed to a wooden donkey, which is pushed into the marketplace where he is publicly cut to pieces and his head is mounted on a pole.
Okay. Did his prisoner get any of his skin?
No, so this is the other guy. This is the other guy who was on the boat.
Oh, okay.
So then...
Because I was going to say that another thing you can... Because I've spent a lot of my life extraordinarily depressed, and one thing you can do when you feel like your life has no meaning that helps is crafting, and I thought that she would probably quite enjoy crafting a little kind of maybe a skin quilt or something, if that might help.
So there's no skin quilt mentioned.
Okay, that's a pity.
Lui Hong was taken to the crossing where he killed Chen. And his heart and liver are cut out and thrown into the river as offerings by Kaishan, Waiju, and Xuan Zhang as a family.
Oh, that's nice.
And afterwards, they burn a written eulogy to Chen.
Oh, lovely. I hope she got at least some of the skin. I think she deserves that much.
But as this little eulogy was going on, a yaksha was patrolling the river again, and he finds the spirit of the eulogy, because apparently when you burn a eulogy, it leaves behind a spirit that the spirits can take and read.
I like that.
So he takes the spirit of the eulogy to the Dragon King, who, as you recall, has been holding on to Chen's body and soul for the last 18 years. And tells him, hey, I can finally reunite you with your family. And they shove his soul back in his body and send him up to the surface with a wish-granting pearl, two rolling pan pearls, and 10 bales of mermaid silk.
10 bales of mermaid silk. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I do not know where you get a silk from a mermaid from.
My mind isn't contemplating it.
I'm messing. I'm pretty sure it's silk, you know, woven by mermaids.
Woven by mermaids. Yeah. Well, I mean, I bet it's from the eyes. Just from, like, your tear ducts.
back on the surface after burning the eulogy, Wai Zhao tries to throw herself in the river and drown herself.
Oof.
But Xuan Zhang holds her back from jumping in the river. Yeah, and while that's happening, they see Chen's body floating back to the bank, and it suddenly springs back to life.
Wow.
Yep. Everyone is pretty shocked, but they all get together and explain all the shit that's happened to all of them for the last 18 years and reunite as a big family again.
Cool. Okay. Nice. I do, however, the implication is sort of there that they could have chopped his soul back in his body anytime.
Yeah.
Or did...
Yeah, no, they could have.
So they just kept him there for 18 years for what, the free labor?
I guess because I don't know.
They just kind of forgot about him until they saw this eulogy and went, oh shit, that guy.
It's they were just waiting for a poetic moment.
Okay.
I don't know. He's a dragon. They're romantic creatures, probably. I don't know.
Okay, maybe. I don't know. I haven't met many.
So they return to the capital, and they do pick up Chen's mother at the inn again on the way.
Good. Good. Because I was worried.
And they have a huge banquet in Atminster. They have a huge banquet at Minister Kaishan's house to celebrate everyone being surprisingly alive.
Yay! Happy ending?
Nearly. It's a little not happy. Yin Kaishan asked the emperor to promote his son-in-law, and he's given the job of sub-chancellor of the Grand Secretariat. I guess he has 18 years of dragon experience. It's probably good for something.
Yeah, I mean, he's dragon trained, you know.
But Xuan Zhang wanted to stay as a monk, and he went to the Temple of Infinite Blessings to study there.
Okay.
But sometime later, Wai Zhao still ends up taking her own life.
Oh.
It's not really elaborated on it, and the chapter just ends with that.
Well, you know, PTSD doesn't leave you really easily, does it?
No.
In fact, that, you know, it is quite literally brain damage.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Damn. Hope she had at least a couple of happy moments.
Yeah. So, I feel like an asshole going from that to diving into my footnotes.
Okay. I'm sorry.
But also I don't want to dwell on it very much, so... But
That's fair. That's fair.
Yeah, the tone of this chapter is a bit noticeably different. And there's a possible explanation for that in the simply that this chapter was not in the oldest extant version of the novel that we have.
Oh, shit.
So it was possibly added... at a later date.
Like a director's cut kind of thing? Or?
Possibly. There was the broad strokes of the events mentioned in this novel, or mentioned in this chapter, are mentioned later on in the novel in kind of poems and stuff. But the chapter itself is apparently not in the oldest known version.
Okay.
So there's a bunch of stuff in the introduction about from Anthony Yu kind of saying, you know, this chapter is a bit controversial, but he thought it was kind of necessary to understand stuff. I will note that, units and footnotes and measurements is something I've kind of gone on about a little bit about.
Really?
Yeah, there is actually a footnote explaining the mermaid silk, saying that a bale is specifically 18 Chinese feet of silk.
Okay, I feel like you set me up for something there when you said explained the mermaid silk thing.
There is also another footnote like explaining that there is like legends of mermaids like spinning silk as well. Like that is a kind of an established folklore thing.
Okay. I just love you.
No, it's the let. How many shirts can you make from this? It's important to know.
Yes.
Okay, and in like footnotes that might be interesting to someone who's not me.
I'm not making fun of it. I'm sure, like, if there are more people out there who get excited about measurements, I am happy for all of you. Your enthusiasm and your happiness is important to me.
The last thing is that Anthony, you notes that the chapter mentions a three-stage examination, and that's historically inaccurate to how exams were conducted in the Tang Dynasty. And
interesting.
He definitely knows more about, or knew more, he's dead, about the historical context of this book than I ever will in my life. But I feel like the much more interesting question is, do the examinations line up with the Ming Dynasty examinations the author would have taken? And
interesting.
Wikipedia is to be believed, they do.
Okay.
So in Ming Dynasty, they had these like local three-stage examinations and then an imperial examination if you passed those. And the first stage was questions asking for one's interpretation of the four books and five classics, which make up the Confucian canon. So those books are more than 2,000 years old. They're written sometime before 300 BCE. You'd have to do... So even when this book was written, those books were more than 1,000 years old. And you had to write some essays on those. And then the second stage consisted of an essay and five critical judgments, including writing a piece in the style of an edict, an announcement, and a memorial.
Aww.
And the third session was five more essays on the classics, historiography, and current affairs. And then if you passed all that, you get to the imperial examinations, which is one session, which is more essays on the classics and current affairs.
Interesting.
All essays had to follow a specific formal outline called the eight-legged essay. So, spider essay, I guess.
The spider essay.
Yeah. So, they had eight sections: an opening, amplification, preliminary exposition, initial argument, central argument, latter argument, final argument, and conclusion. And you had to stick to this format, and the length was between 550 to 700 characters, which is kind of shorter than I would have expected.
Characters?
Yeah.
Well, oh yeah, I suppose like it's, yeah. I don't know how that would translate to, you know, words in a Latin alphabet.
I think most words would just be, you know, one, two, or three characters. But yeah, that's kind of shorter than I would have expected, but you have to write half a dozen of these in one exam session, so I suppose they couldn't exactly be asking for a PhD thesis.
Like, I am, by all accounts, a wordy motherfucker, and I'm just trying to think how I would do, like, an argument with that many points to it in, if we were talking about, like, let's say one character, one word in 500 words.
Yeah. I suppose they're all probably written under the assumption that they're all on these literally thousand-year-old books. They're all on well-trodden ground, so you're kind of on the assumption that whoever is reading this is intimately familiar with what you're writing on. So there's probably not much in the way of, you know, real introduction or much in need of explanation of the topic.
That is fair. That is fair.
And I guess we don't know that Wu Cheng'en was the guy who wrote these, but he's kind of the, you know, the person who's most commonly credited with writing this book, and, you know, this is the shit he had to go through to get into the civil service that he very quickly just quit again.
Yeah, the disgruntled, aspiring civil servant and reluctant novelist is just an arc that I enjoy thinking about.
So yeah, that is everything I have for this chapter.
Cool. Awesome.
Our sign off. We should probably pre-record our sign off because we are never enthused about doing it.
No, self-promotion is hard.
It is. Self-promotion is very hard, and I'm very bad at it. So please make your friends listen to this for me.
Yes, please do. Please do. If anyone wants to do a promotion for me, you can have like 50% of what I make from my creative work, which is nothing.
You can have 50% of what I make on this podcast, which is minus 12 euro a month.
Minus 12? Oh, oh no. We need like a... Do we at least have a coffee on this?
No, I've never bothered setting one up.
Set one up. Come on, you can't be paying 12 euro out of pocket for...
If I make a coffee, you can find it on our Twitter, Monkey King Pod. And I'm on Twitter at Oakreef, OAKRWF.
Cool. I am on Twitter at Taoiseach O'Trash, which I hope Quiva will spell out in the show notes so I don't have to. I run a bunch of fun shows on the Hysteria Network, which you can find on Facebook, including but not limited to the Nerd Herd, which is a thing that happens on Thursdays that used to be stand up, and now it's just like there are lots of PowerPoints and costumes. No one's quite sure what's going on there, but you know, it's evolving, and that's a thing that happens.
Cool.
So yay, thank you very much for listening.